The University of Detroit Mercy presents another encore presentation of a classic Ask the Professor radio program. Today's show takes us back to June 2003.
The University Tower chimes are ringing right up Livernois to the DeWitt House, where we are taping our last Ask the Professor of this year. I'm verklempt. This is too much. So welcome to the radio show where you match wits with University of Detroit Mercy professors and their special visiting faculty in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. I'm your host, Kathy Bush, and today we have so much of the panel here. It's just such a panel. Who'd believe it? So let me start introducing them. That's right. To my right, from the College of Engineering and Science and the Director of Pre-College Engineering Programs, it's Dan, the Depths at Man Machio.
Greetings, Kathy.
Greetings back at you, Dan. And sitting next to Dan from the Department of Mathematics and Math Education, and now himself going through the rigors of math education.
Oh, yes.
It's Professor Jeff Boats.
I have a question. Have you ever noticed that no one has ever seen Bert Tilly and Oriel Adams in the same room at the same time?
Ooh. Wow, sort of like Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, you know?
This could quite possibly be a scheme by Bert to get even more volume of questions.
There you go. The possibilities are endless.
Best man of reconstructive
so surgery. So, listeners, if you have any information on this dual sighting, please let us know. And sitting next to Jeff from the Department of Philosophy, it's Chair and the head sister of the HCCs, it's Professor Beth Olchar.
Cool. Good to be here.
So glad to have you, dog. And sitting next to Beth at the far end of the table from the Department of History, another chair as well. We just got so many chairs here tonight. It's Professor Roy Finkenbein.
Well, to paraphrase Jimmy Buffett, I'm living on key lime pie.
Yeah, and it was exquisite. Yes, indeed. Roy's wife brought a wonderful, wonderful dessert to this last farewell get-together for the year. And there's like maybe a little bit left, but that won't last too long. On the other side of the table, we have our distinguished visiting faculty with us today, Professor Drew Warner being one of those.
Greetings and salutations, Kathy.
We're glad to have you with us, Drew. And junior faculty, Michael Bauman, who moved into an administrative part of this program, and he is interning right now.
Living the lie.
He is. He's doing it all. How's it going, Michael?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I have to apologize for my lack of apparent General Hospital knowledge.
Don't worry. We can get help for that.
Revisionist history.
Yes.
Of course. And also, I'd like to say, I hate you guys so very much.
Seriously, you guys.
Seriously. And I'm out of here. And our last chair, but certainly the last shall be first, it's Professor James Balfour Tubbs.
Thank you, Kathleen.
You are nice very to be here. Welcome. All right. This is the show where you send in questions, and if you stump the panel, you win something. And if you don't stump the panel, you still win something. So come on.
You can email Ask the Professor at atp@udmercy.edu or visit the Ask the Professor Facebook page.
We left off last time with a set of questions from the one, the only, Bert Tilly. And we left just at that point where I'm going to give you a list of cities, and you will name the Canadian province in which they are located. Okay, Port of Climax, Grandmother's Bay, Thunderchild, and Grizzly Bear's Head.
Can we say those on here?
Prince Edward Island.
No. No, no, no.
Oh, those are all in the same province?
All in the same province, one of the prairie provinces.
Saskatchewan.
Yes, very good. Virgin Arm and Herring Neck.
This is a porn movie.
No, this is an eastern province.
Where the winters are long.
Those ones in eastern Pennsylvania.
Newfoundland?
Yes, it is Newfoundland.
Know the ones in eastern Pennsylvania there with the strange names?
No.
It's an intercourse.
Intercourse and Bird in the Hand. They're all together, one little county.
Mary, save us. Okay. Swastika, although Swastika at one time was changed to Winston during the Second World War.
They changed it back.
Bent River, Payne Court, and Swords are all in this province.
Manitoba.
No, very close to us.
Nebraska.
No.
Ontario?
Yes, it is Ontario. Yes, Swastika was an Indian name, and it was very close to Kirkland Lake, home of Betty Dunleavy Bush, the Mammy. So, yeah, there we go. So I heard the story of Swastika since I was just a little Hitler youth, you know, kind of thing. Okay.
I knew when I dial your phone number, it makes a little lightning S.
Yeah, I know.
And that word,
yeah, I know.
No? They changed it back.
I'm sorry, but you know what? Bert beat us, guys.
You the man, Bert.
So,
but it was on those last few questions.
there you go. But we got to make sure.
Another
T-shirt to the pile. Our next set of questions, all five of them, are from Bradley Lewis of Altadena, California. And Bradley. He maybe sends shorter questions, but they're always very interesting. Who was the first and only president to earn an undergraduate degree in political science?
First and only?
Kennedy.
That's scary.
No.
W, wasn't
it? Oh, the first, just the first one?
Yes, it was Woodrow Wilson.
Wilson?
Yeah.
No. Oh, you said a graduate degree?
Undergraduate degree. Okay. Yeah.
I thought Bush's was in, W's was in political science. Or is it history?
History.
It was in partying.
It was in strategic. Well,
definitely. Who was the first American president to play golf?
Taft.
Yes, it was. No, it was him. Yes.
Boy, could he drive
well. I was going to say.
Could
really.
He roll down the fairway well?
What year was the advent of the banjo to America? Now, we've got some choices here. 1640, 1740, 1840, or 1940?
I think 1840.
That's a tricky question because actually variations of the banjo which were derived in Africa came over in the heads of slaves. So,
well, this is really taking it from a Euro perspective. It certainly is not
as
taking
usual?
It that way. Yeah.
1840?
It is 1840. Yeah. That does seem a bit late, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Hmm. If children are studying the Suzuki method, what are they studying? Yes.
Violin.
Yeah.
Oh, violin.
Violin. And also cello, right? Yes.
I know a three
one of our consultants here had
Suzuki
a
method,
yes.
Violin.
Yes, and piano. All types
not the
of
sax?
Things that way. Not the sax.
Well, just sax and violins would go very well with the other questions we've had today.
Absolutely. So we thank Bradley for those questions, and he does note that he wants an extra large T-shirt this time. So we'll make sure that it's an extra large that gets sent out.
Have we been gaining weight since the last time we watched?
I don't know.
Or maybe the other one was too small.
I've been sending out larges. I've been sending out extra larges. But well,
maybe his washer has very hot water.
Or maybe he just fried it in that dryer a little too long.
Maybe like us, he eats while doing the show.
Yeah, there you go.
That could be it.
Our next set of questions comes from Tony Bliss of Madison Heights, Michigan. And he writes here, I couldn't believe that when I took my first vacation in 6 years in February, it was the same two weekends that you played my set of questions. So hopefully I might get to hear them someday in a repeat. A large number of people told me they heard the questions, so that's a testament to your show's popularity. Thank you for making my Sunday mornings more enjoyable.
He knows a lot of bakers, doesn't he?
I was going to, really. So he tells us, okay, all you Hepcats and radiophiles, it's the wizard magically coming to you across the airwaves with more questions designed to beguile learned wonders. 17 correct out of 21 will be enough to defeat the wizard.
Oh
so
God.
What's that?
Tough percentage. 64%.
No, we're way up. 17 out of 21?
17 out of 21.
Oh, I'm sorry. I went to
81.
No, 5 times 17 less a little bit. I'm up by 4.
Okay.
Excuses.
82%.
The category of radio has again been selected. In 1926, Freeman Gosson and Charles Carell invented what type of radio format that is still used on TV today? Yes, it's a situation comedy.
Amos and Andy, right?
Mm-hmm. You just think without them, he notes, we might never have had Friends or Frasier.
Or Seinfeld.
Yes, so there
that would
we go.
Be a bummer.
Thanks for that recovery.
But okay. Who developed reality TV and
I
what
want
do we need
dead.
To do?
Where do we find
I know.
For her?
Yeah.
Mary Ellis Bue.
Another sign of the coming apocalypse.
Yes,
the Anna Nicole Smith show.
I'm curious who coined the term reality.
Yeah, so really.
It's not
really
you know, because you know, living in a house paid by MTV is reality.
Or people getting paid $1 million to marry somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah,
there
you go.
I've been
off
still waiting for my check.
Every day. What made Command Performance unique in the history of the entertainment industry?
What made unique?
Yes, Command Performance. Yes, what made Command Performance unique in the history of the entertainment industry?
Command Performance sounds like something GM would add to its cars or something.
No.
Command Performance.
It happened. It was radio, and it occurred during the Second World War.
This is War of the Worlds.
No, not War of the Worlds. No. They were requests that people could request actual programs, songs, a specific band or singer.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's just a cat. Don't worry.
The question is a little...
Yeah, it's a little vague kind of question. But he said, it's great to see entertainers of our time supporting the troops just as strongly as they did in the Second World War. This sinister character host of Detective Story Hour in the 1930s was recast in 1937 as a mystical crime-busting sleuth himself.
The Shadow.
It is. What
oh,
evil
come on,
lurks
I knew that.
Evil laugh.
Who knows
the
what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
The Shadow, dude.
Shades of Married with Children. This 1947 radio show starring Donna Meachie and Francis Langford was creator Phil Rapp's realistic answer to Father Knows Best and Ozzy and Harriet? What's the name
the
of
Osbournes.
That show? No. In fact, the show stayed on the air for 4 years. So this is Don Ameche as the husband, John, and Francis Langford, the band singer, as Blanche. Mm.
The worst thing is I think I may actually remember having seen this once, but I don't remember what it
was. See what your radio looks like when you listen to it.
I thought you said TV.
No, no, these are radio questions. So, yeah, Don Ameche and Francis Langford. The show was called The Bickersons. Oh, and John, the husband, had narcolepsy, and the wife was an insomniac. I think what a wonderfully winning idea. You know, I mean, imagine that.
Also,
you know?
He could eat no fat and she could eat no lean.
You know, that's just so great. Bud Collier, who was radio Superman for 12 years, continued to play the Man of Steel in the 60s and 70s. But on what venue was he able to do this?
Cartoons?
Yes. Collier joined many of his radio stalwarts on Sunday morning cartoons, playing Superman on Superman cartoons, the Justice League cartoons, and the Batman and Superman Hour.
Yeah.
I think I missed that.
All three of your favorites.
I'm guessing that by that point in his life, visually, he was no longer the Man of Steel.
Well, they do note here that...
visually or in any other way.
Yeah, if you combined all other portrayals of Superman together, it wouldn't add up to his time as the voice in tights, is what's noted here. And as we think about Men in Tights, let's take a break.
It's an Ask the Professor flashback.
On my right, from the Department of Religious Studies, the chair of that department, Professor George Pickering.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
Pleasure to have you here, as always.
Right.
On his right, from the Department of Theater and Performing Arts, Professor Arthur B. It's been a long 3 weeks. And on Arthur's right, from the Department of History, and the Assistant Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and the Director of the Learning Center, Kathy Bush.
I'm too tired to say hello.
I know. It's one of those months. Anyway, and on my left, from the Department of History, the chair of that department, Professor Sarah Gravel.
Why, Evan, you must have whose car is in the way. I just want to get out, but I can't because there's that car in my way.
It's Rosalind Carter.
I've been trying to back up.
She's been hitting my car.
You're listening to an encore presentation of an Ask the Professor program from June of 2003. Matt Mayo and the current panel of professors return next week to begin a brand new season of Ask the Professor. So email your questions today to atp@udmercy.edu. Now, let's return to this encore presentation of Ask the Professor from June of 2003.
And we're back. This first radio Western was also the first television Western that was aired in 1949. Name that program, and it's very connected to this city.
I'm thinking The Lone Ranger.
It is. It's absolutely The Lone Ranger. He notes that The Lone Ranger had thrilled radio listeners for 23 years, bringing the Old West to radio and also to television 16 years after the radio debut. 1952 caused the first legal battle over the character rights when both TV and radio Lone Rangers were accidentally booked for the same promotion. Now really, who was that masked man? I'm telling you. This radio show came out of CBS founder William Paley's order to create a Philip Marlowe of the Old West. Name that program. Philip Marlowe of the Old West.
Paladin?
It's a cool idea, but I didn't really see it. But, oh well.
Hmm.
William Paley had more money than God, so he got whatever he wanted, radio or TV-wise.
A detective of the Old West.
Detective of the Old West. Yeah. That's how I see Philip Marlowe as this, you know, like a thin man kind of character, not... The show's Gunsmoke.
Huh? Oh, really? Wow, I was going to guess that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Mr. Dillon?
Yeah, Mr. Dillon. Hey. Nina Mack, the fairy godmother of radio, discovered dozens of child stars for this children's radio show she created and directed from 1929 to 1954. This is on CBS Radio. And some of those that made the cut were Anne Francis, Arthur Anderson of accounting fame.
Other fame now.
Pre-fall.
Dick Van Patten, director Lamont Johnson, who became the voice of Tarzan eventually. So this
children's
was a
radio program.
Children's
Not
radio program.
Or anything like that.
No, this is a little obscure. The show was called Let's Pretend.
Very obscure.
Yeah, very, very obscure.
Went off before I was born.
There you go. Bold Venture was created when this husband and wife team announced that they would do a radio show if someone would only give them a script that they could work on together.
George and Gracie?
No. Actually, she was a New York model who came west and actually starred with him in a movie, Howard Hawks film. And that's how they became a couple. Her given name really is Betty, but she went by Lauren.
Lauren Bacall
and
Humphrey Bogart.
Humphrey Bogart, yes. Oh. They set sail for adventure 78 times, and receiving joint pay of $4,000 an episode as hotel owner Slate Shannon and his ward, Sailor Duval, a young girl willed to him by her father for her protection.
No relation to Sailor Moon, right?
No,
they
I guess.
They were so wonderful.
Yeah, but it would be interesting to hear that. In 2 years, The Simpsons will overtake this show as the longest-running family show in broadcast history. If you don't count, it's 10 years on radio and 2 additional years on television in the 1970s. Name that show.
Family show?
It's a family show. It was so family. Like, get the insulin, okay? Although...
No. It's not the Waltons.
Not the Waltons. This goes... The show aired in the 40s, 1944 to 1954 on radio before it moved to television. He was a band leader, and she sang in his band.
Obadi Obada.
The only band leader I know is Ricky Ricardo.
No, but good guess. It's The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
I wondered what profession he had.
Yes, that was really... He
he seemed to hang around
the house
all the time
a lot. Well, you know,
TV
the
show.
Band kind of broke
he was
off.
Working on the Homer Simpson butt groove.
There we go. Yeah. The program was on air for 10 years with the real children, convincing them to let them play themselves from 1948 onward. It then aired for 14 years on television, and an additional 2 years until Ozzie's death in 1975. So he said, if you want to count The Simpsons' 3 years on Tracy Ullman's show, then you'd have to count Ozzie and Harriet's 4 years on the Red Skelton show. From 1940 to 1944. Go Ozzie, give me Rocky Road ice cream over beer and Butterfingers any day. So he's obviously an Ozzie and Harriet fan. Orson Welles returned to radio in 1950 to star in The Black Museum. What was the premise of this dark-toned radio program? Oh, wow. You know, this would be so great to hear this program. Think of a really classic role that Orson Welles played in, later role.
Citizen Kane.
No, this comes a bit later. This was a film that was actually shot in Vienna, like post-World War II Vienna. Very full of mystery and murder and intrigue and spies. It was The Third Man. He reprised the role of Harry Lime. Welles reprised this Harry Lime as the Third Man character to take listeners through Scotland Yard's legendary galleries of death. Each week, he focused on an item associated with a brutal murder and acted as the narrator through this chilling reenactment on radio.
Oh, awesome.
And that would be. He'd have a great voice
kind
for that, wouldn't he? Yeah, yeah. Why did Pepsodent willingly increase the budget, almost doubled it, for the Pepsodent show for the final 7 years of its 10-year run?
We didn't want to be like the British.
It actually had a very patriotic reason because of its host, the person who hosted the Pepsodent show. And we've mentioned this special happy birthday boy.
Chester A. Arthur.
Yes, indeed. He was the star of the show. And Bob Hope wanted to have the shows aired from military bases. And it's said that Pepsodent didn't even bat an eyelash when he requested the increased budget. After 10 years in 1948, the Pepsodent show became the Bob Hope show. For another 7 years. And he notes, happy 100th birthday, Bob. Thanks for all the memories.
Cleveland, Ohio, as I recall. Right?
Yes, yeah. From England to Cleveland. Land of the Cleves. this famous detective series was created by a former felon, about a former felon who turns detective, and was unique in that it took so long to get to radio that it pre-existed radio for more than 2 decades in pulp novels and movies. So there was a whole series of these that were done on radio and then on film. And it's an alliterative name, an Eastern Seacoast name, and a color. So a city in the Eastern Seacoast.
Red Richmond.
Not Red Richmond. Try Boston Blackie.
Oh, okay.
Boston Blackie aired on the radio from 1944 to 1950 after dozens of pulp novels and 14 Blackie films, half of which were silent movies. So, I mean, very long-lasting career here.
I've never heard of him.
When O. Henry created this character as a murderous outlaw in Caballero's Way, he never envisioned that he would become a hero of radio, stage, television, film, and song. Think O. Pancho.
The Cisco Kid?
That's right. It was the Cisco Kid.
Well, Cisco Kid is a friend of mine.
Yes. Yeah, Cisco Kid did star Warner Baxter and Oscar in 1949. It was a radio hit from 1942 to 1956 before it crossed over to TV with a hit song by War in 1974.
There you go.
We're getting creamed on these questions.
We sure are.
But these are such wonderful questions.
They are. Great questions.
Absolutely. This star, who played squeaky-voiced teens Oogie Pringle on A Date with Judy and Walter Denton on Our Miss Brooks, said that he owed his career to Eve Arden and asked that his star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame be placed next to her. Can you name that star? This guy is really interesting because he also later played a character on The Real McCoys. He played Luke on The Real McCoys.
Richard Crenna,
yes. Oh. Mm-hmm. It took the Vietnam War and Rambo to toughen up old Oogie, you know, too.
Remember him in Rambo.
Definitely.
Better get more body bags.
Indeed. This sci-fi radio show was the first to regularly feature stories by Block, Bradbury, L. Ron Hubbard, and Vonnegut. The name of its pilot episode, The Outer Limit, in 1950, was taken as a name for a popular 60s show. What was the name of the radio show? It's a great name, too. It aired from 1950 to 1951.
It's in the TV show.
The radio show is called Dimension X. Mm-hmm. And then when it crossed over to TV...
Came Outer Limits.
Yes, became The Outer Limits.
I like Dimension X. That's a cool...
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a great name? I know. That's fabulous. You want to go where everyone knows your name. This popular bar was the eyesore of the East Side from 1941 to 1952, yet somehow had dozens of celebrity guests generally playing themselves. You heard Ed Garner as Archie the manager, vaudeville star Eddie Green as Eddie the waiter, but in 11 years you never heard a word from the owner except from Archie's frequent phone calls to and from him. What was the name of that tavern?
Moe's?
If only I could get a flaming Moe right now. The show was called Duffy's Tavern.
And when did it run?
1941 through 1952.
I bet they didn't serve Flaming Moe's.
I bet they didn't. Though it aired from California, this long-running radio show simulated the excitement of a Broadway opening night in the Little Theater off Times Square. What was the name of this show? It brought popular Broadway shows into every home in America from 1933 to 1953.
How many of us listened to the radio 50 years ago?
Oh, the First Night Program. Here we go. Some more Detroit stuff. Detroit's WXYZ radio made history in 1933 when it created the Lone Ranger, and again in 1936 when station owner George Trendle ordered the creation of a modern-day Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger's great-nephew became a crime fighter with his own sidekick.
Yes, the Green Hornet.
Yes, who was that masked man? Yes, the Green Hornet aired on Detroit radio from 1936 to 1952.
You mean the Cato show, right?
Well, he said, though, I'd put Cato over Tonto.
It's the Cato show.
Any day of the week. Speaking of Tonto, why did radio's Tonto, John Todd, shy from public appearances after 1940? Why did he stop making public appearances?
Because Tonto means slow?
Like Wohila means wealth? No. Okay. Well, no, it's Wohila means fire. It was his age. He was 60 when he began as Tonto in 1933.
So he became a mature sidekick.
So, yes, he was the radio voice of Tonto well past age 80.
Wow.
Okay.
A really mature sidekick.
That is. Now, one more question he says about the Green Hornet. What was unusual about Bob Hall, the radio's Green Hornet for 7 years? What was unusual about him?
He was colorblind?
He kept getting him mixed up with the brown one.
No.
He was blind and thought he was on television.
No. It was his age. He was a teenager when he first won the role of the Green Hornet in 1944. So he was 17 then. So not bad. Okay, I think we got stumped, guys.
We got stumped.
Dumped.
Crushed. Is
These were wonderful These questions, though. Questions. You know, they really were. Oh, so we'll have to stop there. So let me thank our panel, Professor Tubbs.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Professor Bowen.
Thank you all.
Professor Warner.
Thanks for having me back.
Professor Finkenbein.
Talk to you next season.
That's right. Professor Oljar.
We'll be back in September.
Professor Boats.
Marry us part and marry us meet again.
Okay. And Professor Maggio.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now this...
It's an Ask the Professor flashback.
The University of Detroit Tower Chimes ring in another session of Ask the Professor, the radio program on which you match wits with University of Detroit professors in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. Questions today about Melville, Charles Dickens, Tolstoy, and the Cambrian rocks. How's that? Today's panel, I'm the man with all of the questions and most of the answers, Bill Raby. On my right, history professor Frederick H. Hayes.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Professor Hayes. On my left, Russell McLaughlin of the University of Detroit Green Room Programs.
How do you do, I'm sure?
Yes. Thank you, Professor McLaughlin. And our middleman again, Professor John Mahoney of the University of Detroit English Faculty.
With approval of that, certainly. How do you do?
All of the questions used on this program are submitted by listeners. If you stump the expert, you will receive a subscription to a national magazine, The Atlantic, Harper's, or America. Now, this message from the University of Detroit. Thank you. This question is from Carl Budd, B-U-D-D, of Detroit, Michigan. Actually, he sent three questions, and again, we warn the listener, if you're going to send three, send them all in one batch.
You can't divide 16 by 3.
No, but you can divide the sheets on which he writes them into three.
Yeah. But each one was sent in a separate envelope, you see.
Yeah, so he's wasting 12 cents there.
Yeah. I see what you mean, Fred. Yeah. I bow to that brilliant piece.
Send them all in one envelope.
Brilliant piece of economic mathematics.
In Charles Dickens' Pickwick Papers, what was the name of the law firm which represented the plaintiff, Mrs. Bardell?
Oh, that was, wait a minute, the, give me a little tiny clue, will you?
Well, you may have a little trouble seeing the whole thing clearly. It may be sort of misted over.
Dim and dimmer.
Wait a minute, just, will you give me the first name of the firm?
Dodson.
These questions.
Dodson and Fogg.
All right.
Dodson and Fogg.
All right, half credit for that one.
You can email Ask the Professor at atp@udmercy.edu or visit the Ask the Professor Facebook page.
Ask the Professor was transcribed at the facilities of the DeWint Dining Room here in beautiful Detroit, Michigan. Ask the Professor is produced and directed by Michael Jason with technical assistant Narelle Rogers. Our executive producer is Dr. Barbara Bowles, and we wish Michael Bauman the best that life can bring. I'm your host, Kathy Bush, and we'll see you in the fall.
A brand new season of Ask the Professor begins next week, so send in your questions today and make plans to listen to the show.